paralegals at Nelson & Murdoch, and welcome to Circuit Court Entertainment, where we discuss how laws and history affect all forms of media. And today, we are discussing something pretty important, but in the background of everything. Accessibility! The history of disability in the United States is a long and complicated one. But while there have been pockets of unity, for example, Gallaudet University, which is focused on deaf students, was founded in 1864, the true disability movement did not start until just after World War II. At the end of the war, a lot of people returned home and found both camaraderie and a society that was not designed for them. While various movements flared, it wasn't until the end of the Vietnam War that a lot of this was solidified. More camaraderie, more disabilities, and the U.S. had decisively lost after a long fight. People were upset, and they also had some very specific needs. Now, if you're wondering why it took that long to make a disability movement, when ancient Egyptians had prosthetic toes, ancient China attempted at medicating mental health, and the Code of Hammurabi itself mentions cataract surgery, well, obviously the answer is ableism. What is less obvious is the ugly laws. Openly developed around the late 1800s, ugly laws, called that officially, mandated that people who were obviously physically or mentally disabled not appear in public unless it was part of a demonstration, such as a circus. The laws were not always enforced, but they were still legal until the 1970s, and in that time there was a mass eugenics movement to sterilize disabled people, among other things. As a result, a lot of disabled people were either hidden away, lived with other disabled people, or forced to blend in. The ones who could appear in public would be the ones who could either hide their disability, or whose accessibility devices were either normalized, think prescription glasses and some canes, or were subtle. Fortunately, though, our first example of media and disability interacting predates that. Braille was one of the first major historically recent advancements in accessibility. It started in 1824, and it uses raised dots to represent letters. Louis Braille created the system, and it builds off previous versions. The first book printed in Braille, A History of France in French, was released in 1837. The first printing press does not seem to have been developed until 1919, and it took until 1924 to print the Bible, one of the most widely translated books, into Braille. I've been trying to search for Braille wide release books, but so far all of my efforts are not turning up any real examples. What I am finding seems to show Braille was limited to mostly specific library lendings, specific printings, and until 1996, possibly needed to ask permission from the publisher in order to make the printings at all. All of these hampered Braille books from being widely available. Going onto Barnes & Noble right now shows you can search for audiobooks or large print books, but no special division for Braille. This can keep blind people from reading the latest or most popular books, harder for people to get presents for blind people in their lives, and if they can be found, they are much more expensive. For example, I looked up Bridgerton books due to the popular Netflix adaptation. A Braille copy of the fourth Bridgerton book is $98, pre-tax, at a specialty Braille store. The paperback is $17 pre-tax at Barnes & Noble, and it does not offer a Braille copy. In 1932, the American Society for the Blind took advantage of the next technology available to people, and this one was much more easily available. They started creating audiobooks. Records had been recorded as far back as the 1850s, but it wasn't until Edison in 1877 that they took off. And by 1925, music recordings were being easily sold. Unfortunately, the recording quality was not at the high level we see today, but it was an option that didn't exist before. The first audiobooks recorded important items like the Constitution and Shakespeare plays, and in 1933, the Library of Congress got approved to make their own audiobooks, instead of relying on items in the public domain. This led to more popular books like Rudyard Kipling and the P.G. Wodehouse Jeeves series. It took until 1934 for the long play record to be produced for audiobooks. Publication companies were worried about lost sales, and the American Foundation for the Blind had to make a special deal to mark the LPs as only for blind people to listen to. after they point out playing records of books in specific times in concert halls would not really work. In 1955, the Listening Library was founded, and it not only created more audiobooks, but let people who were not fully blind listen to them, such as partially blind people or even fully sighted people who were just busy. This continues to progress as records change to cassettes and CDs, which were much more portable, cheaper, and by that point, people were much more open to audiobooks. Closed captioning was a more technical process. The Bureau of Standards worked with ABC to figure out how to actually do it. This started in the early 70s, and they eventually figured out you could encode the closed captioning into the broadcast signal, and it was first shown off in 1971 at the National Conference on Television for the Hearing Impaired. This was followed up with a special airing of the Mod Squad for deaf students at Gallaudet, the College for the Deaf in Washington, D.C. PBS joined the project later that year. Julia Child on PBS in 1972 had an open caption where they just showed up for everyone, no special equipment needed, but they could not be turned off. The ABC News was also re-aired on PBS with open captions, but this ran into a few technical issues. For example, the ABC rebroadcast was at 11, 5 hours after its normal airing and often competing with PBS's own news. On March 16, 1980, closed captioning officially debuted to the public with The Wonderful World of Disney. Closed captioning was encoded into the broadcast signals and could be turned on or off with special sets, therefore limiting this technology to those who could afford it. When they were officially released, it cost $250 through Sears or just over $950 today. But it continued to grow. In 1982, the Academy Awards became the first televised event to be closed captioned in real time. 4 years later saw the first and one of the few disabled winners who could proudly celebrate her victory, Marlene Matten, the Deaf Oscar winner for Children of the Lesser God. Much like with records, as technology improved, so did closed captioning and subtitles. Eventually, in the 90s, closed captioning was included as part of the TV set itself, eliminating the need for special equipment and letting captions and subtitles, two different things, play at the watcher's convenience. Though this was not done without legal help. The cost of the sets, combined with the cost of transcribing, especially live events, led to few closed captioning programs as too few deaf people tuned in. It took the Television Decoder Circuitry Act of 1990 to get the closed captioning chips inside of the televisions themselves, and legal updates in 96 and 2010 combined with proof there existed an audience for closed captioning beyond just the deaf, such as the hard of hearing, people with English as a second language, or young children learning how to read, for it to be as widely available and accepted today. But nowadays, the law has failed to completely keep up. Netflix was sued for missing subtitles in 2011, and other online video formats such as YouTube and TikTok do not mandate subtitles or check if the subtitles are accurate. Audio descriptions came much later. Audio descriptions consist of a person narrating the action on the screen, such as character and location descriptions, how they move about in a space, and so on. Versions of this started in 1985 at the PBS station in Boston, WGPH, but was first offered in theaters in the 1990s. In the early days, some of the first pushes had either celebrity narrators or was an actor involved with the movie, but it was framed as more of an entertainment possibility compared to an assisted device. When it was introduced to theaters, people watching the movie need a special device that plays it just for them. So that, plus the hiring of voice actors, makes it a more expensive accessibility option for the theaters. As of right now, the top broadcast and cable networks have to provide 50 hours of descriptive audio per quarter, leaving large swaths of video unnarrated. However, the streaming services have been doing much better, and it's due to one specific show. Or rather, the push for one specific show. 2015's Daredevil on Netflix. Daredevil, created in 1964, is a blind Catholic lawyer named Matthew Murdock who uses his enhanced super senses to compensate. While that trope is a whole separate discussion, he's a fairly popular B-list hero that always just missed making it big. Netflix in 2013 successfully bid for the rights and produced Daredevil. played by Charlie Cox, this was not Daredevil's first attempt at the screen. However, the previous version was not well received, both plot-wise and in regards to Matt's blindness. This version worked behind the scenes to make sure Matt came across as blind, even with his super senses. Season 1 had scenes which included adaptive technology Matt would need to use in his day-to-day, even with his super senses, including his phone announcing the name of incoming callers, a watch without a faceplate, and a braille screen reader, along with additional scenes that showed Matt working around his blindness as a lawyer and Daredevil, such as having trouble reading expressions. These were, unfortunately, mostly dropped in Season 2 and returned sporadically after that. However, outside of the series, there was a growing push for one not shown in the show. Audio descriptions. After all, Daredevil was blind. Blind people would care. Deborah Ann Wolfe, who played co-lead Karen Page, had been dating a blind man for years. And with Daredevil being a big project for Netflix, they not only agreed and got it up within the next few days, too late for a premiere, but within the month, they agreed to go back to all their old media and retroactively add audio descriptions, and would continue to do it in the future. And it has been kept. I just went on Netflix to check, and while Delicious in Dungeon, an anime series dubbed by Netflix, lacks audio descriptions, Ultraman Rising, Beverly Hills Cop XLF, and Disenchantment did, along with several non-Netflix movies such as Shrek, Ghostbusters Afterlife, and Madam Web. Many new releases continue to include descriptive audio, such as Twisters and Deadpool and Wolverine, though additional work needs to be done for older shows. Monk, a popular detective series from the early 2000s, still lacks audio descriptions. One device shown in Daredevil, the screen reader, has proven more important as the media shifts more and more online. Screen readers have become more and more integrated as the internet has become more and more necessary for human interactions. Now, alongside integrated text-to-speech, many websites and social media will also offer alt text ID, which allows people to input descriptions of the picture. Unfortunately, right now it's still being sorted out, and while sometimes the alt ID is fairly clear, such as black text on a white background states whatever is in the screenshot, it can quickly get more complicated. If you are doing an alt ID of Marge Simpson, I just think they're neat meme, do you say it's Marge or do you describe her? And since the Simpsons are a stylized humanoid figure, how do you describe her without making it sound like some sort of eldritch abomination? How much unnecessary details to be put in? What makes it unnecessary? Do you just need to get the vibe across? But while this is still being worked out on a casual and legal level, text-to-speech is here to stay. Especially because it did create one of the most iconic video game villains of all time, GLaDOS from Portal. Starting on Windows 2000, the computer could read out the words on the screen. While synthesized voices were not a new thing, the earliest confirmed voice synthesizer is in 1779, what was mostly shown was more pre-programming of voices. For example, typing in text would let the computer know how to say it. One of the earliest modern examples of this was in 1961 when IBM showed off one of their computers singing Daisy Bell, a historical event that would end up being referenced in 2001 A Space Odyssey with HAL 9000. And while voices have improved a lot, in my sources I have linked both the IBM version of Daisy and fame-synthesized, fictionalized singer Hatsune Miku also singing it. Hatsune Miku is a synthetic voice bank program with a character design on top, but over time has become as popular as many real-life singers. Voice banks can still come across as muffled and robotic. Look, this is just mostly for me to transition to talk about video game accessibility, but it is a fact that when designing GLaDOS, Valve ran the dialogue through a text-to-speech synthesizer, and people found it funnier than so they really leaned into it. And GLaDOS did eventually end up meeting HAL 9000 in LEGO Dimension. But back to the point, game accessibility has always been complicated. The nature of video games as both a visual medium with characters quickly and autonomously changing locations on screen, information being displayed and changing frequently, the need to put in inputs, so motor disabilities involved here more than in movies, using sound effects to indicate things and significant text-based info being displayed or needing to be retained, can cause problems easily. For the most part, subtitles in some way, shape, or form have been a thing since the early years of gaming, since there wasn't always voice acting. But as time has gone on, they are not always present or can be difficult to see. Or not everything is subtitled. Not all games are screen reader accessible. Elden Ring, a game released in 2022, famously does not have a pause button for difficulty reasons. But that also means people with motor difficulties can't pause and rest their hands in any one of Elden Ring's many difficult boss fights, which is the bulk of Elden Ring's appeal. Then you have flashing lights that may be a staple of the medium, but can cause seizures, color blindness making information hard to read or discern, or directional guidance causing confusion with players with memory issues, and so on. Fortunately, in recent years, the tools available for accessibility have improved. A lot. The Last of Us Part II, released in 2020, had loaded it with enough accessibility options that a blind person was able to fully complete the game. Alan Wake 2, which has frequent jump scares, released a patch to tone that down. Spider-Man has major controller remapping options, and Microsoft put out a special controller that was designed with disabled people's inputs so they can map it to play games. By nature of the medium, it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. What works best for The Last of Us won't work as well, for example, in a point-and-click game like Nancy Drew. But we're not quite done. While accessibility is continually lauded in the industry, there's even a special award at the Game Awards for Most Accessible Game, it's not mandated, and no one is punished by a lack of options. Actually, it wasn't until the Game Maker's Toolkit, a popular YouTube channel, launched a series discussing accessibility in games that led to this uptick. While some of this was probably in the works beforehand, he drew attention to it, and within the next year, a lot of games either used his exact suggestions, updated it to include them, or had something similar enough. And it snowballed. Mostly in game space, but outside of it too. When Barbie was released on HBO Max, a new language option was available. ASL, or American Sign Language. This is significantly different than subtitles or closed captions because ASL and the deaf community do have their own subculture, and all sign languages have their own sets of grammar, linguistics, and so on, such as any other language, such as Albanian, Maasai, Tagalog, and Cree. Unfortunately, with a vocal-heavy society and Alexander Graham Bell inventing the telephone while disapproving of deafness despite marrying a deaf woman, ASL has never been as prominent as it should have been, despite its formalization around 1817 and its usefulness in a number of situations even for people who can speak. The earliest reference to any form of sign language is in the 5th century BC Plato, and the first reference to it as an actual form of complex communication is in 1492, but it absolutely existed earlier. Plus, as discussed in Children of the Lesser God, that movie that Marlee Matin won her Oscar as a deaf woman who does not want to talk in searching to find her identity, emphasis on oralism can lead to the same out-of-sight, out-of-mind effect the ugly laws tried to push on the U.S. citizens. So while there are very few ASL options right now, ignoring movies designed around ASL like Coda, A Quiet Place, Barbie, King Kong, New Empire, Wonder, and Echo, the fact is ASL options with deaf actors and translators are there. And ready is a good move and should spread and normalize ASL, which is kind of the point. Accessibility and adaptability are both tools that let disabled people join into the wider culture and be included, but also helps abled people in just casual ways. I've streamed games for friends where the first thing that goes on is the subtitles. I've watched Daredevil with audio descriptions when doing other things. I've had to look away during flashing lights, not because I'm epileptic, but because they can hurt if overused. I've used sliding doors and cut curbs to get around. This helps everyone, and we can always use more. Thank you for listening to Circuit Court Entertainment. If you found this episode interesting, please tell others as this is a new podcast. Please subscribe and leave a review on all the major podcast services. You can find me on Twitter at @CCEPod and Tumblr at Circuit Court Entertainment. This episode was written, edited, and recorded by me, Mina. The script was edited by CJ Peterson. Podcast art by Empress Cirque on Twitter. Thank you for your time, and I hope to hear from you soon.